Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, and I'm joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, unions and high culture. So, Richard, we've seen two incidents recently, one in New York and one in Minnesota, where the world of organized labor has sort of intruded on the world of high culture. Tell us what happened in these situations.
Well, I mean, they're very different kinds of situations, but ironically, both of them involve Carnegie Hall, which is, shall we say, one of the ultimate destinations for serious music. The internal dispute had to do with the question of who was to staff the new facilities that Carnegie Hall was going to build in its educational wing. This is New York City, and so the thought that any red-blooded American charitable institution would resist unionization is simply beyond the thought. But the question is which union? And their attitude, that is the management attitude, was, look, this is not stage. This is instruction. We'll go to an education union. We will not go to the stagehands. Now, there's a reason for wanting that. There are five full-time stagehands in New York with mysterious parts otherwise added. Between their base salary and their overtime, they average about $419,000 a year. And for electricians and carpenters, things like that. There are only five of them. And so what happened is they stage a strike. And of course, they stage it at the point that it will cause maximum inconvenience, which is opening night where they have this gala performance. The dinner went on for the New York literati at the Waldorf Astoria, but the concert did not. And then the question was, how long and protracted would this particular strike be? And it turned out it settled itself relatively quickly. And then the question is, who won and who lost, I suppose. And I could talk about that in a bit. The other strike was a kind of a different strike. The Minnesota Orchestra is, in fact, at this point, regarded as one of the great regional orchestras in the United States, in large part because there's a man named Osmo Vanska, who is Finnish and thought to be an inspiration to anybody who works with him. But the musicians are organized in Minnesota, as they are in most places. And one of the things that you discover is when times aren't going as well as you would like, the musicians have to negotiate cutbacks. And the only question was not whether there were cutbacks, but how deep and how long. Now, these musicians, I think, started at something like about $135,000, so it should not escape you that skilled musicians are earning one-third of the salary of the Carnegie Hall stagehands. But management wanted to cut them fairly deeply because they had something in the order of a $7 or $8 million deficit, which they had to close. And when you start talking about places like Minneapolis or other symphony orchestras, labor is the only place in which you have discretionary inputs. So it's the only place where you could make serious cuts. It's not as though you could cut the electric bill by 40% because those are relatively standardized commodities. And in bad times, unions dig in their heels. Their attitude is, we know we're taking a risk, but if we win, we get all of the gain. And management says, we know they're taking a risk, and if they win, we lose everything. So these things essentially tend to be fairly protracted. And just about the time of the stagehand strike at Carnegie Hall, what happened is the Minnesota Orchestra threw up its hands. They didn't get an agreement. And Mr. Vanska announced that he was resigning because he said he could not prepare his players in time to perform in early November at guess where? Carnegie Hall. So what happens is we have a kind of disorganized Minnesota orchestra, and then we have a rather quick settlement of the strike for the labor hands and the stage hands, and it's a nice question to ask, like, why the difference?
Well, how about that? Why the difference, Richard?
Oh, you pick up on these wonderfully. I got to say it, Troy. You're just the man after my home heart. Well, it turns out that if you're talking with the stagehand stuff, what they're trying to do is not to preserve positions. They're trying to extend them. And what happens is the individual workers do not want to go out on strike in order to make the world safer for two or three other individuals who earn the kind of salaries that they do. So if it turns out that the cost of staffing the shall we say, the educational wing with four or five of these guys is going to be the same $2 million. It's like setting aside $40 million in endowment. And the management is going to fight hard on that. So what they do is they contrive a deal in which the current workers essentially sacrifice future employees. So what they say is, we'll make sure that our contract runs for 4 years, which means that they solidify the current high rates against all sorts of ambiguity. And then they have this kind of jurisdictional limitation where they will get to do some work at reduced rates in this other wing, but won't be the dominant staffer. So they save face on the one hand, and they keep their own prerogatives on the other. Generally speaking, one of the things that's constantly underestimated in union analysis is the conflict of interest between workers. There are jurisdictional fights, there's seniority conflicts, there's new work fights and so forth. And all of these things cost management an enormous amount of money. Sometimes they don't much care. They just want the thing to be over because the wage rates are about the same. But in this particular case, if you're looking at $419,000 a year as opposed to, say, $75,000 or $100,000 a year, the difference really matters. The point about this is that when you get to the Minnesota Orchestra, they don't have that option. Everybody's in the same boat. There is not a bunch of future workers who are trying to horn in whom you could just throw off. Everybody has got to share the pain. So these unions essentially typically divide between a hawk and a dove wing. And the hawks are saying, we've got to stand together. We have to hold out. This town will come through. The charitable donors will be behind us. We could raise the ticket prices. Maybe we could get more recording contracts or whatever it is. And the doves want to do the opposite. And it turns out often the hawks make more noise than they win. But it's a game of chicken. And sometimes when you play a high-risk strategy, you lose. And that happens with many unions. Minneapolis, for example, is the home of Northwest Airlines before it merged with Delta. And you want to talk about a union which had really terrible relationships with its firm, that turned out to be it. And it's probably not a complete accident that Minnesota is the home of the Farmer Labor Party, both groups which essentially constantly are looking for government protections of one kind or another. And it may well be that the history of the politics of the state influenced the deal. I don't want to overstate that because virtually all unions or all orchestras are unionized, and sometimes they have these problems. Typically, in good times, everybody manages to paper over the difference, but in bad times, these things come out. And I think the workers just played one strike too hard, and in the end, they came out the worse for what they did.
Richard, when we talk about culture, you mentioned in your writing ideas that the baleful influence from unions isn't just limited to the fine arts. You also talk about its influence on the world of sports. So give us an idea of how union power plays out there.
Well, you know, sports are a very kind of odd type situation because it's quite clear you're not dealing with a bunch of electricians who would like to earn $72 an hour instead of $47. You're dealing with athletes whose individual power is just enormous in the marketplace, and the dispersion of their wages is very, very great. So you can't sort of have everybody play to scale and hope that your best players will be satisfied taking the wages of their worst player. So what unions worry about are what they call the freedom issues, the extent to which they can sell their services to the highest bidder. But this is a very complicated calculation because it is understood by everybody that the highest bidder in an unrestrained competitive market would in fact be those franchises that operate in major cities which have high values, New York, Dallas, Los Angeles, Chicago, whatever it turns out to be. If in fact these teams all get loaded, the other teams become impoverished, and when that turns out to happen, nobody wants to go to the games because you want to see something that's close. You don't want to see a 44-point rout every time you work there. So the league has to have a form of balance, not because they're socialists, but because essentially they know if the imbalance gets there, everybody gets hurt. And so what they try to do is to find ways in which you could limit the amount of money that can be paid. And sometimes you have salary caps. Sometimes what you do is you say that only a certain fraction of the total revenues that are collected can be done to wages and so forth. You have various kinds of penalties. It's a very complicated formula that takes place. And in this particular situation, it's easy for the players, again, to say, we've got to be tough. And so what typically happens is, say in the basketball strike, the players had gotten something like about, 53 or 54 or 55% of the revenues devoted to salary. And then the best players gobble up a huge portion of that. Management comes back and say, 19 out of 34 teams have lost money and there are only three or four that have made it. And then the union guys come back and say, show us our books. And of course, the accounting is never crystal and clear when you're trying to worry about how you annualize the profits. So they fight over all of this. And then the workers go out on strike. The management sits there. It's a straight economic struggle. And the question is, who's going to blink first? And in the end, given the threat positions, it turns out usually the players, quote unquote, lose. Not big, but lose. And it certainly happened that way in the last basketball strike. The teams that shut down, they inconvenienced their vendors, they inconvenienced all the restaurants nearby. They're huge negative third-party effects, which are really terrible. But if the firms were losing money, for them to shut down, they're losing less money. So they don't take a financial hit when, in fact, they are relieved of the net cost. The players, most of them do not have all that long a career. The guys like Kobe Bryant, who can play from 1996 to 2013, but most of these people have only 3 or 4 years in the sun. And if they decide to take 1 year in strike, their skills erode, probably going to knock off another year because of being less skillful in the playing. They'll go overseas and they'll play in Europe and they're in a tenth of what they do here. But essentially, the strike loses. And so that's what they did. They came back at 50%. And I remember thinking about that. That's the number, if I had been the union guy, I would have suggested at the beginning. So there is this tendency to kind of overplay a strong hand. In my own kind of world, I don't think there's anything so terrible about reserve clauses that allow you to bind a player to a multi-year contract. What I do think is dangerous is allowing all the leagues to merge into one so that you got a monopoly on the employer side. If you, in fact, for example, allow competition between the AFL and the NFL, there's less need for a union because you would always get two teams from different leagues bidding on the same players. But the folks there are very nervous about it because they're worried about the imbalance that might take place between the two leagues. And, of course, if you remember, the AFL and the NFL joined. But these are essentially situations where they're very high stakes. There's a lot of monopoly power. There aren't many close substitutes. And there's this constant battle over the division of the surplus. And that's what tends to lead to this bluff and counterbluff. And it breaks down. We've had hockey strikes, football strikes, baseball strikes, right? Basketball strikes. Every major sport goes on strike. You're not going to see a strike in some minor sport because there just isn't enough money to extract by trying to play those high-risk strategies.
Final question that I'll ask you. You write in the piece, quoting you here, in recent years, industrial unions have lost their power because the firms that they seek to unionize do not have any ability to raise wages given the rising competition that unionized firms face in their own product or service market. So let me ask you, because there's often confusion about the views of union critics. Your position that labor unions now, given the realities of the modern, 21st century economy, have simply become outmoded, or have they always, even prior to these circumstances, been a less than satisfactory vehicle for organization? Are these flaws intrinsic, or are they just a function of the way that today's economy is structured?
No, there's so many different answers to so many different parts of the question. The first question is, what is the power of a union to extract gain? If you go back to corporatist America with monopoly telephones and so forth, three big auto companies in 1935, 1940, these companies have power over price to some degree. A union comes in, they say, look, you want to stay in business, give us some share of your monopoly profits. When you go to mining, there's some technical notion called a quasi-rent. And what that means is if you're in a coal field where the coal is close to the surface, you could get it out for a very low price. And then you sell it into the market at a much higher price. And the union comes along and says, you can't leave town. We're going to shut you down unless you agree to share those rents with us. As markets become more competitive, that strategy no longer works. Because if your employer can't raise prices in his markets, how are you going to be able to get the higher wages? You'll just force them out of business. So strikes have become relative rarities today. Does this mean that unions are harmless because they can't strike? Unfortunately, the answer to that question is no. because what they can do is to try and create the monopoly conditions that allow their individual units to work well. So the unions become leaders on making sure that foreign steel is not imported. The unions become leaders to making sure that Walmart doesn't come into New York City, where in fact it will put pressure on the less efficient union supermarkets that locate in town. And so on it goes. So that what happens in the current situation is that the unions are less powerful at the bargaining table, but they exert an enormous and basically baleful political influence in stopping things that they don't want from happening in order to preserve things that they do want to happen. So it's a different kind of exercise of power. It's certainly nothing like what this was in 1946, when if you go back and read the history at the end of World War II and the relaxation of all of the external constraints on production, there was a strike wave. It was so massive that the Congress passed Taft-Hartley, which was a Republican Congress, and they got enough Democrats to go along with it that they could override the Truman veto with respect to the legislation in question. It was a remarkable change. But I can't think of any positive functions socially that unions serve, because if they're an ineffective monopoly, you don't need them. If they're an effective monopoly, you don't want them.
All right. Thanks, as always, to Richard Epstein and you, the listeners. And remember, you can find Richard's weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org. And you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. For the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sanek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. Thank you for listening.